they feel their separation, in many cases, they don't come. But also, in many cases, you have really bad people coming in and using children. They're not their children. They don't even know the children. They haven't known the children for 20 minutes, and they grab children and they use them to come into our country.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And we begin today with the news that the Trump administration is considering once again separating children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Responding to the backlash from the first time the administration tried this policy and then had to reverse it through executive order, they are now considering detaining families seeking asylum together for 20 days and giving parents a choice. Either have your kids stay with you in detention for months or years as the case makes its way through the process, or allow the government to take your children to a government shelter. Last week, a report from Amnesty International citing U.S. Customs and Border Protection data showed that more than 6,000 so-called family units were separated from April to August of this year. That number is much higher than the original 2,500 reported. In an interview with Leslie Stahl from CBS's 60 Minutes, President Trump was asked if he would repeat the policy.
When you allow the parents to stay together, okay? When you allow that, then what happens is people are going to pour into our country.
So are you going to go back to that?
Well, we're looking at a lot of things. Really, what we want to do is change the immigration laws because they're a laughing stock all over the world.
Are you willing, though? I think you're saying it's under consideration.
No, I want all the laws changed. There have to be consequences, Leslie, for coming into our country illegally.
Joining us to discuss this is Dara Lynn, senior immigration reporter with Vox. Dara, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
What is the so-called binary choice option that the Trump administration is looking into?
So the binary choice is between essentially indefinite detention and separation. The way that it's been laid out by the Post is that after the 20 or so days that families are currently allowed to be held together in detention, the parent would be given a choice between you can waive your rights under the Flores settlement and we'll keep you together in detention until your asylum proceedings are done, or, second part of the binary choice, you can waive your rights under the court settlement in the family separation case, and your child will be taken from you and placed in an Office of Refugee Resettlement facility. What isn't clear from existing reporting is whether that's going to be better tracked than it was under the first round of family separation, or whether a parent would be essentially giving their child up for adoption. As we've seen from the Associated Press and other outlets reporting, some of the children who were separated have been without the consent or knowledge of their parents. So there's a lot of unanswered questions here on a policy level. Given this administration, though, it's not really clear whether those are questions that would be answered before the policy went into effect or whether we'd be dealing with the same thing we were under family separation in spring and summer when everyone was scrambling for answers, including the Trump administration itself.
What are the apprehension numbers at the border been like recently?
So the administration is reacting to a very big spike in August. Especially of children and families, which brings apprehensions of children and families in particular up to where they were under the late Obama administration. There was a surge in apprehensions October through December of 2016 that then plummeted when Donald Trump came into office. So even though the Trump administration's reactions through spring and summer were somewhat out of proportion to where apprehension levels were, they were kind of reacting to apprehension levels that were fairly normal for the last several years. The last month, or August in particular, has shown a really big spike that is unusual even for the last several years. So they are reacting to something real on the ground. The question, though, is whether promising harsher treatment is going to change that, because we didn't see big changes in the numbers when family separation was in effect. And in fact, internal DHS communications show that they actually expected there to be a drop once they introduced family separation, and that didn't happen. So it's not at all clear what will be able to deter families who, remember, are largely coming to seek asylum and from countries where there's either a great deal of instability or, in the case of Guatemala, desperate hunger.
I was going to say, if you can remind us a little bit about why people are coming and what these spikes represent, that would be helpful.
there's not a clear tie between what's happening in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, which is the northern triangle of countries from which a lot of families are coming, and the flow up to the U.S. It's a kind of complicated interaction of what's happening in those countries, smuggling networks capacities, what the Mexican government is doing, because Mexico has been a really forceful partner for the U.S. in apprehending and detaining Central American asylum seekers. But there is evidence that, for one, Guatemala is going through a big emigration surge to the U.S., which U.S. officials attribute to hunger, which would not make them eligible for asylum, but doesn't necessarily stop them from wanting to come. Meanwhile, Honduras and El Salvador continue to be in the grip of a great deal of violence, homicide, gang control, which is something that in the past has been a possible asylum claim, and which the Trump administration is trying to narrow the legal grounds for on asylum as well. But there's a difference between what can get you legal status ultimately in the U.S. and what is compelling enough to make you leave your home country and get to the U.S., even if it's just, you know, slim chance that you'll be allowed to ultimately stay legally.
Dara Lind is a reporter with Vox covering immigration. Dara, thank you as always.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Leon Fresco, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, who was also head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Leon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So is family detention even a viable option? I mean, are there even facilities available to make this happen?
Well, yeah, that's the correct question to ask, which is that of the numbers of people coming across the border each month in terms of family units coming across together, you're only going to be able in this scenario to still be able to detain about 5 to 10% of the families if your intent is to detain them during the entire course of the removal process, because the removal process could take anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, even in some of the best case scenarios. And so if you are detaining people for that time, that means new people coming in won't have a bed to be placed in unless you dramatically ramp up the existing 3,000 or so beds by another 10 to 20,000 beds. But this is something that will take years to ramp up, not months or, you know, even 1 year. And it will also take billions of dollars more in congressional appropriations, which are not currently forthcoming.
So let's talk a little bit about the specifics. I think this is, as many of these stories are, fast moving and very complicated. The Attorney General Sessions announced a couple of months ago that the administration would no longer offer asylum to those who were fleeing domestic abuse or gang violence. Who at this point is allowed to seek asylum in the United States legally?
Well, anybody could try to seek asylum by saying that they have a credible fear that they will be persecuted in their country on the basis of race, religion, national origin, social group, or political opinion. So there's those five protected factors. What Attorney General Sessions tried to do was to shrink the social group factor to not include cases of domestic violence or cases of gang violence. But it's kind of hard for him to do that as a categorical basis because it's still possible to articulate a claim if you can show that the government was actually hostile toward your effort to report that you were a victim of domestic violence in your country. He just made it much harder and made it sort of more complicated to shoehorn your claim into that standard. But to eliminate it entirely, there's litigation going on right now challenging his ability to eliminate it entirely, which is why you're seeing these complications on the border, which is, you know, the intent was to sort of create a virtual wall where people couldn't come here and claim asylum. But that's not happening because he's not able to write a decision that forecloses this type of asylum in its entirety.
So that was actually going to be my next question. Like, has this family separation policy, as it was originally known, not this new version of it that the president is talking about, has that actually deterred people from coming to the United States?
I think the simplest way to describe this is to say that any short-term enforcement effort that's different than something that had been done a month or two ago will have an effect in a short-term incremental manner. But in the long term, the issues really come down to the conditions in the home country and the conditions in the United States. And so in the long term, the demand remains the same.
And we often talk about the 1997 Flores court settlement, which essentially prevents the administration from keeping children in immigration detention indefinitely. How does that decision play into what the president is suggesting?
Well, it plays a major role because to the extent that it limits your ability to detain children in any facility, then what it's doing is it's saying that you can't detain them whether they're with their parent or whether they are in any other facility other than what's called an Office of Refugee Resettlement facility that will be designed to specifically hold children in settings that are designed to look more like schools than are designed to be detention facilities. And so that was the debate over the last 5 years, was could you get around that settlement if what was happening was a child was not coming by themselves but was coming with their parents? And what the court basically said is only under very, very, very limited scenarios can a child be housed with their parents, only for a very brief period of time of 20 days. And so now what the Trump administration is trying to do is to say at day 20, okay, mom, you now have a choice. Do you want to stay with your child past day 20, or do you want us to take your child away and try to move them to one of these ORR facilities? And they're trying to bank on being able to recreate family detention by moms choosing in every one of those scenarios, hey, I want to stay with my child.
I'm wondering, over the summer when this initial family separation policy was implemented, there was a huge media outcry. Americans were very upset with what was happening. And here we see it potentially being lobbed again. And I'm wondering, is this something that's part of a strategy? It seems very haphazard. Or is this something that's just meant to rile up the base and really create a distraction from some of the larger issues that are playing out today on the national stage?
I think there are three things going on all at the same time. One, it is correct that immigration gets used when other things are not going as well. They pivot back to immigration. But two, what happens is the policies get derived from the numbers that they see each month. And so if they see that the numbers are going in a certain direction, then they feel like they have to make some reaction to it. And so then third, they always return to this issue of deterrence and try to figure out what they can do to deter. And so then the third issue becomes, okay, well, we couldn't do it with prosecutions because that seemed too much to people. So now let's do it by being able to say, well, mom chose to be with the child or mom chose to separate the child. And they're hoping that that has a slightly less stinging rebuke than the mandatory prosecution weight of doing it.
Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney and former head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Leon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
President Trump says he'll send Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Saudi Arabia after the disappearance and alleged murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. On October 2nd, Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, and hasn't been seen since. According to reports, Saudi officials allegedly tortured, murdered, and may have even dismembered the Washington Post columnist, claims which the Saudi state strongly denies. On Friday, reports emerged that Turkish authorities have audio and video recordings confirming that Khashoggi was killed inside the Saudi consulate. Those recordings have not yet been made public, but now Saudi Arabia says Turkish officials can search their consulate. Meanwhile, U.S. senators are pushing the Trump administration to consider sanctions on the Saudi government, and business leaders are pulling out of a future economic conference being hosted by the kingdom. Sara Aziza is a journalist covering human rights in the Middle East. Hi, Sara.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So if the Saudis have denied any involvement in the disappearance of Khashoggi, and so far that's been absent any proof, as far as we know. There was just a breaking news alert that they are now allowing Turkish investigators into the consulate. What's your sense on what that could mean?
Yeah, that's certainly an interesting development. However, it really remains to be seen how cooperative the Saudi officials may be. And we have had outside officials allowed on the premises once before, but it was very tightly controlled, sort of more of a curated tour than an investigation. Keep in mind that the Saudis have had almost 2 weeks to make whatever preparations they might need to in order to ensure that this quote investigation would go favorably for them. So it's perhaps a positive development, but, you know, we should be definitely be skeptical of whatever may arise from that visit.
So, of course, President Trump, the world has been watching to see what the United States reaction would be. President Trump was on 60 Minutes this weekend, and he said that there would be, quote, severe punishment if the Saudis were found to be involved with Khashoggi's disappearance.
Would you consider imposing sanctions as a bipartisan group of senators have proposed?
Well, it depends on what the sanction is. I'll give you an example. They are ordering military equipment. Everybody in the world wanted that order. Russia wanted it. China wanted it. We wanted it. We got it. And we got all of it. Every bit of it.
The question I have for you is, what kind of punishment are we talking about? He's sort of talked around sanctions. Are sanctions still on the table?
That is definitely a matter of debate at this precise moment. We've had some members of Congress saying that they would want to go that far. You know, for the U.S. that has such a strong and longstanding economic relationship with Saudi Arabia, sanctions are treated sort of as the ultimate boundary of the possible. It's a red line for some people who tend to want to focus on more incremental, perhaps more cultural, soft reprimands towards the Saudi government, whereas others say that that is the only really effective way, the only way to really convey the level of severity that they see in this case. So I think what everyone's really watching is the threat that Saudi issued in response to some of these hints, which is threatening to raise oil prices, threatening to retaliate as far as their oil production goes. So we will have to see what risks our government is actually willing to take. But oil and weapon sales are certainly the meat and potatoes, the foundation of our relationship with Saudi Arabia.
And you did speak with Jamal earlier this year. What did he tell you regarding the Saudi state and the Saudi crown prince?
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke with Jamal Khashoggi several times for a few pieces I was doing on the escalating crackdowns, the growing suppression of all types of free speech and free expression in the kingdom. And Jamal really shared with me some of his concerns that while Saudi Arabia had never been a bastion of human rights or free speech, there had been a little bit of latitude, a little bit of space for the press, for academics and religious leaders to perhaps differ with the royal family to a degree within some, pledge of loyalty to the Saudi royal family. However, under Mohammed bin Salman, we saw an increasing pattern of preemptive strikes. The crown prince was locking up people who had not necessarily criticized him at all, but whom he just feared might object. Right before he gave women the right to drive, for example, he locked up a lot of the country's most conservative clerics in order to sort of head off any conservative critique. And then at the same time, he was censoring or arresting academics and intellectuals on the more liberal side, sort of just demonstrating a need to completely control the narrative from the top down as far as his reforms and his reputation. And Jamal, as a journalist, really felt like he could no longer practice his craft as a journalist with any integrity. Many people were being asked to sign loyalty pledges. He was receiving increasing pressure from the government, and he grew really disheartened with the regime. He loved Saudi Arabia. He really expressed a lot of regret that he had felt the need to leave his family and his job and many, many colleagues behind. But he told me, you know, Saudi Arabia deserves better. And this crown prince may market one thing, may market a bright future for Saudi Arabia, but without freedom of speech and freedom of the press, that's a really hollow promise.
Sarah Aziza is a freelance journalist focusing on human rights. Sarah, thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ever since 2012, North Dakota has been trying to implement more stringent voter ID laws. Courts have already repeatedly struck down the toughest parts of those laws. But last week, the Supreme Court allowed one of the most contentious voter ID measurements to go into effect ahead of the midterms. Now, North Dakotans will have to present an ID with a residential address. A P.O. box alone is not going to cut it. And that's a problem for nearly 5,000 Native Americans in the state because the Postal Service doesn't deliver to homes in rural reservations. John Hegeman is North Dakota Capitol correspondent for the Forum News Service. John, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how exactly did this happen?
Well, if we want to go all the way back to 2012, that was the year that Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp was elected. She's the only Democrat elected to statewide office here in a very Republican state. After that election, the legislature started implementing voter ID laws. For a long time, the state allowed people to sign affidavits, basically self-certifying they are who they said they were and that they were voting in the correct precinct, or, you know, allowing them to have a poll worker basically vouch for who they are. You know, in a lot of these small towns, people know each other. They say, that's Bob down the street. I know who he is. He can vote here. The legislature saw some problems with that, some potential instances of double voting, and they got rid of those two options. Now, you know, Democrats and I think Heitkamp herself would say that it was more about addressing her victory or a response to her victory in 2012, whereas Republicans would say, you know, we're trying to protect the integrity, is the word they use a lot, integrity of the ballot box.
Has anyone argued that this disproportionately disenfranchises Native Americans from casting a ballot, particularly just a couple weeks before the midterm elections?
Well, I think the plaintiffs have argued that over and over, and they seem to, you know, find success in the lower court with that argument. They had a victory that the plaintiffs did. They notched a victory right before the 2016 election that brought back the affidavits, actually, for that election. But then the legislature came back last year and passed a new voter ID law that's the subject of the appeals that are still ongoing right now.
John, if I'm somebody who's affected by this, if I'm somebody who does not have a street address and instead just has a P.O. box, what can I do to rectify this?
What the Secretary of State's office has said is that there is a position in every county called a 911 coordinator, and that person, if you call them, can, according to the Secretary of State's office, pretty easily go through the process of actually assigning a residential street address to your home, and they can provide you a letter reflecting where your residential address is. And if you still show up to the polls on election day and you still don't have the proper ID, what the state is saying is that, you know, you can cast a ballot that's just not put in the count yet. It's quote unquote set aside, and you have a week after the election to come back with a, you know, proper ID. So you have that kind of buffer, I guess, after the election to rectify that.
John Hegeman is North Dakota Capitol correspondent for the Forum News Service. Don, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free, Babbel.com.
We're just about 3 weeks out from the midterm elections, and in Georgia, a heated battle over voting rights is playing out. Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp is running against Stacey Abrams, a Democrat who would become Georgia's first black woman governor if elected. But activists are suing Kemp, who as Secretary of State oversees the voting system. They claim some 53,000 voter registration applicants are on hold. The majority of those are for black voters. Kemp says that he is not intentionally trying to diminish the black vote for his own gain in the election. The Takeaway reached out to his campaign and they responded to our email calling this a, quote, manufactured crisis created by Stacey Abrams and used by Abrams to fire up her base of supporters. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. Andra, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
When we hear about efforts to disenfranchise Georgia voters, what exactly are we talking about here? Can you tell us what these 53,000 applications actually are?
Well, in this case, it is the issue of exact match. So when people fill out voter registration applications, they may leave out hyphens or accent marks. And there's also the possibility for human error. So if you fill out a paper application form and it goes to your county elections office and somebody actually forgets to put the hyphen in or forgets to put the apostrophe in, then after that, they check the name against some type of official government record, like a driver's license record or perhaps a social security record. If the name has not been transcribed identically to what is actually on your other government ID record, then that application is flagged as needing additional verification. And in the state of Georgia, you have a certain period of time, about 2 years, to be able to go and get that corrected before you'll officially be added to the voter rolls as a voter. This is a longer period than before, but the Secretary of State's office had been sued and reached a settlement with various civil rights groups to try to remove exact match. But then the state reinscribed it into law and just gave a longer period by which people have to sort of prove how they spell their name correctly.
Andra, I have a question about the 53,000, though. How does Kemp explain that the majority of these, if we're accurate on this, are for black Georgians?
Well, he can't say, he's not going to say that it was intended to be that way. It's just a question of the effect. And so people of color, so not just African Americans, but also Latinos and Asian Americans, are more likely to have their names flagged as not hitting, meeting the exact match standards as opposed to whites.
But for what purpose? I mean, are our names that different? I'm just trying to understand why these groups are targeted more.
Yeah. So, you know, these are names that might not transcribe well. So if you have unusual spellings, non-Western names that people aren't familiar with, you can see it in an instance where Mary and Joseph and John are more familiar to people, whereas somebody who has a hyphen or an apostrophe or an unusual spelling of their name might accidentally be transcribed from paper into the electronic database incorrectly. And that's more likely to hit people of color.
Andra, when we were talking about the Kemp camp and what their reaction has been to this. And when they've been confronted with accusations that they that the Kemp camp had actually engaged in disenfranchisement, one of the things they point to is that they've actually increased the number of voters in Georgia by 1 million people. Does that defense work here?
I'm not sure that it works here. I mean, I think we have to ask a question about if there's a particular verification practice that has a disparate impact on people of color, it might stand to reason to, that you might want to revisit that particular policy. So it's great that there are more voters in the state. I'm sure Stacey Abrams would actually probably argue that she and her campaign helped contribute to that increase in voter registration. But we do need to make sure that the services are working smoothly and that they work smoothly across demographic groups in the state.
Now, we've seen earlier attempts to close polling locations in largely black voting districts. We've seen accusations of voter disenfranchisement, both from the Secretary of State's office and now the legislature. Regardless of what happens here, what are there any things that voters who are on those rolls right now, anything that they can do to make sure that their right to vote is ensured on Election Day?
What I, you know, would tell people is make sure that you show up, make sure that you have all the identification. If you have a problem, ask for a provisional ballot so that you can vote on Election Day, and then make sure that you call lawyers who are going to be there and be willing to represent your right to vote pro bono.
Andra Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. Andra, thank you.
Thank you.
In Boston today, a trial is underway that could end the use of race as a factor in college admissions. A nonprofit group called Students for Fair Admissions is suing Harvard University, alleging that the school's admissions policies discriminate against Asian American applicants. Spearheading the lawsuit is a conservative activist named Edward Bloom, who has organized efforts to end affirmative action before. Here's how he describes the problem.
It's racial discrimination and it's a quota. The quota today is against Asians, much like the quota back in the 1920s and 30s was against Jews.
The issues surrounding this case have opened up divisions within the Asian American community. We spoke to a couple of students.
My name is Kenny Hsu. I'm a senior at Davidson College and I'm a writer for The Federalist. I'm an Asian American, but to me, you know, the critical part of that is that I'm an American. And I think that I want to be looked at on the basis of my qualifications and on the content of my character, rather than the way that Harvard is looking at Asian Americans, rating them poor personalities, rating them people that are less desirable to get into college strictly because of their race.
My name is Sally Chen. I'm a current senior at Harvard College, studying history and literature and studies of women, gender, and sexuality. Asian Americans are being used as a racial wedge in a lot of ways, as a way of propping us up against other people of color and utilizing the quote-unquote model minority myth to perpetuate these ideas about who deserves to be in these institutions.
I'm personally for equal treatment of all races, so regardless of your race, ethnicity, I think that people should be treated on the basis of merit and opportunity. And I think that anytime a college decides to implement any kind of racial balancing positions, I think by necessity, it usually involves turning away people who are more merited and taking in people who are less qualified.
I truly believe that my admissions file, my application, could not have been as compelling as it ended up being for my admissions officer had I not been able to talk about my race in a really meaningful way, along with my other identities as a child of immigrants, as a first-generation college student, as someone who comes from a low-income family. It does an injustice to all students, including Asian Americans, to try to portray us as if we are a monolith.
I grew up around Princeton, New Jersey area, so there are a lot of people there who were very academic and very obsessed with college. And so I think that when you have that kind of environment, it really doesn't help when a school like Harvard basically says to you, oh, your application is not worth as much as another guy's application because it looks like you're trying too hard or because it seems like you're not worthy based on characteristics that, you know, we can't change about ourselves.
I don't think there's a person on this campus who could deny that they have benefited from having a diverse student body and a diverse campus. I think that, in fact, the conversation has evolved to actually be more about how Harvard could be doing more for its students to do better recruiting, to get diversity within diversity, thinking about Asian Americans as being comprised of multiple ethnic groups, including Southeast Asians and more recent immigrants and Pacific Islanders.
Joining me now to discuss the lawsuit against Harvard is Natasha Wariku, an associate professor of education at Harvard University and author of The Diversity Bargain. Thanks for being here, Natasha.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in studio in New York is Hua Xu, staff writer for The New Yorker. Hua, thanks for being
here. Very stoked to be here.
So, Natasha, let's start with you. You're currently at Harvard University, which is being sued in this case. Are you involved in this lawsuit in any way?
No, I'm not.
So tell us a little bit about how Harvard's policy admissions work. Where does race factor in, if it factors in at all?
So Harvard has a holistic admissions policy, which means that the admissions office looks at a whole host of factors when deciding whether to admit a student. This includes, of course, academics. But in addition to academics, it's also looking at particular talents that a student might have outside of the academics, like musical talent. Perhaps someone has done some pretty serious science research. They are also looking at athletics and, you know, manning the sports teams. Of course, the legacies are a part of this. And race is one of these factors, particularly underrepresented groups, African-American, Latino, Native American groups, a kind of diverse, make sure that those voices are part of the student body on campus to provide a diverse learning environment.
You mentioned the underrepresented groups. You did not mention Asian-Americans or legacy students, and I'm wondering why that was.
Yes. Children of people who went to Harvard or have some kind of affiliation get a kind of closer look. They get an extra read and, you know, they do get a small leg up. And in terms of Asian Americans, the university denies that they're penalizing Asian Americans in the admissions process. And what the plaintiffs are trying to do in this case is to tie this question of are Asian Americans penalized vis-a-vis whites to are whites penalized vis-a-vis underrepresented minorities. Now, I should say, under the law, there's a compelling state interest to give a boost to underrepresented minorities for this diverse learning environment. The converse is not true between, you know, when we're comparing Asian Americans to whites in admissions.
Well, I want to come to you because you just wrote a big piece about this in The New Yorker. You interviewed several Asian and Asian American activists who actually are in support of the lawsuit. Can you give us a sense of why they feel that way, why they stand there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of division within the Asian American community. It might not be as great as is often reported, but there is a very small, very vocal group within the Chinese American immigrant population that is very much invested in notions of opportunity, meritocracy. You know, they often spoke about the American dream in a way that I think a lot of people who've been in America a while don't necessarily sort of see as contractually binding. And it's just sort of this perfect storm. Edward Blum is really interested in changing the cultural conversation around affirmative action, around race consciousness. And a lot of these predominantly, I would say, middle class, fairly kind of well-to-do, single-issue Chinese-American voters, particularly in suburban areas, they don't really experience the diversity that a college campus might provide for them. You know, they just see this as taking something away from them.
And Natasha, is that true? Is something being taken away from these Asian American students? Because you said earlier that not everyone can get into Harvard, right?
Right. And in fact, very few people do get into Harvard. And I think we have to be clear on what we're sort of talking about here. I think the evidence is very unclear about whether there is any kind of penalty for Asian Americans applying to Harvard. You know, they are Asian Americans who are admitted do have higher SAT scores and GPAs, but this is not how the university admits students, of course, right? There are all of these other factors that I described. And on balance, on all these other factors, white students seem to be stronger than Asian Americans. And that's why you see this discrepancy. So, you know, for example, athletic recruiting, that benefits white students over all students of color and legacy boosts as well. And so, and there are a whole host of other things like, you know, wanting representation from all 50 states of the country. And of course, people of color are concentrated on the coasts. So, you know, then the question becomes, why are we kind of attacking affirmative action when there are all these other policies that, you know, and are those fair? That's a question that I think the university has to answer and is making decisions about, you know, furthering its kind of goals as a university. And I don't know that anyone has the right to go to Harvard.
Well, that's one of the things that's been debated hotly in this affirmative action debate is, you know, who's having something taken away. Well, you spoke to Edward Blum. He was also behind the Abigail Fisher trial that a lot of people might remember, who was the young white woman who claimed that she was the victim, if you will, of affirmative action.
Right.
Is Edward Blum really trying to help the Asian American community in your estimation, in your reporting, or is he really using this as a pawn, if you will, in a broader strategy?
I guess I would hesitate to say he's using them as a pawn because a lot of the activists were already organizing. Like, they were already organizing around issues of college admissions. And, you know, there is precedent for elite institutions like Harvard, you know, tweaking admissions plans when it comes to Asian Americans. In the 80s and 90s, there were a series of cases that the DOJ looked into. So it's not beyond question. And I think Blum is tapping into this sense of paranoia. He's giving a sort of larger narrative shape to a lot of the activism that was already existing. Whether or not he actually cares, I can't really say. But I think there's a real sort of synchronicity in these interests that benefits both sides.
Natasha, Harvard says that getting rid of race would overwhelmingly benefit white students. Is there an argument here for other things like looking at class, which has often come up in affirmative action debates?
Absolutely. You know, I think that to me, these are not either or, right? We should be able to think about underrepresented minority groups because of the history of racial exclusion in the United States. But we also need to do a lot better in elite college admissions in class diversity. You know, these universities are predominantly serving well-to-do families. You know, admission to these places is higher than median household income in this country. And while many students are on financial aid, an overrepresentation of students who are not on financial aid. So absolutely, we need to do a lot more about class. But I don't think that this has to be an either-or question.
Well, I'm curious, your reporting focused on Chinese immigrant community. And I'm wondering, we often use these terms, Asian American, Latinos, et cetera, to really lump together very distinct groups of people. Do you think that this case is revealing anything about the limits of how we define, quote unquote, Asian Americans in the United States?
That's a great question. And I think we're starting to see some of that fracture, because even within the Chinese American population that I spent a lot of time with, there's a lot of differences in how they see the world and sort of how I see the world or how my parents saw the world. So I think a lot of it has to do with where you're getting your information, sort of what your social network is, literally, but also online. A lot of the folks I talked to just had completely different inflection points in their political awakening than someone my age or someone who had been acculturated in the United States.
And we're going to assume that we're a little older than some of the college students, right? We don't have to be specific. Natasha, you're included. We don't have to be specific there. Exactly, right. 22. Natasha, curious if you can tell us a little bit about Harvard's personality rating, because that seems to be something that also factors into this and could negatively impact Asian American students.
Yeah, so I've looked at these the reports of The Economist, and there does seem to be a small penalty for Asian Americans on this personality rating. So they do this, the plaintiff's economist does this analysis where he controls for all of these other factors and then shows that on balance, Asian Americans have a slightly, and it's pretty small, but do have a slightly lower average personality rating. That personality rating is a kind of subjective measure. It's supposed to include things like grit, you know, overcoming hardship, this sort of perseverance, these kinds of qualities. And, you know, I think that it's possible that there is some kind of implicit racial bias at play here. You know, it's hard to, we know from the research on implicit racial bias that that implicit racial biases towards minority groups are pretty widespread in this country. And, you know, there's no reason to think that admissions officers would be different, but there might be something at play here about stereotypes about Asian Americans. I'm willing to believe that might be the case. I think we don't have enough information to know if it is, but it seems to play a pretty small role in the overall decision-making when you look at the coefficient. You
know, well, we've got about 30 seconds left, Juan. I'm just curious, did the students that you interviewed, were they concerned at all about this impact, how this might impact other ethnic and racial diversity at Harvard?
Not particularly among the Asian American students, although I didn't speak to as many. But I do think it brings to mind one of the problems with this debate, which is that it's about this principle of diversity, which was never the originating impulse for affirmative action, right? It was about desegregation. It was about the right to go to school at all. And the fact that it's been winnowed down to this conversation about sort of what the diversity policy of Harvard University is, it's sort of sad when you think about how ambitious affirmative action was once as a sort of a philosophical approach to improving America and achieving America.
Natasha Warrico is an associate professor of education at Harvard University, and Washu is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having me.
And a lot of you have thoughts on college admissions.
Neil Picard, West Palm Beach, Florida. I would eliminate legacy slots and also make the process a blind assessment. Due to bias against certain races and ethnic groups, children who fall into those groups have a higher hurdle to clear to get admitted.
Hi, JC, and I'm from the greater New York City area. I think for college admissions, the process definitely is very, very unfair. Several changes need to happen. First, you need to get rid of preferences for legacies, athletes, and kids of VIPs and donors. Second, the current affirmative action system needs reform.
Joshua Brothers, Holiday, Utah. The college admissions process is fair, but we got to remember that these institutions are businesses first. And what I feel we've done is unfairly propped up secondary education as the gatekeepers of our society. And that unfairly diminishes the value of technical schools, apprenticeships, and other forms of learning. It's extended the length of public education to a point where citizens are forced to pay to play.
This is Robin McCoy from Castro Valley, California. My child had a college admissions counselor. She's a smart kid, got good grades, and had an excellent ACT score. But I also feel that not everyone has the opportunity she had, and that for a kid who, like me, was poor and didn't have good parental support, it would be much harder to get into college, especially now.
It's one of my favorite parts of the show when everyone calls in, so thank you for your comments. You can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.